Right? So to go straight to the point, we have to make the most of the LHC data because every single event is precious. And just a quick introduction of data volumes at the LHC. Back of envelope calculations, we have 40 million collisions. If we recorded everything, we'd get to volumes bigger than Facebook. Okay, not a big deal, but still, we're not Facebook. So we have to select events. We have to process all these events in order to make a selection, and we only have to select the interesting events. So this is how we do it. This is the Atlas CMS and LHC B trigger systems. And here you just want to point out the stick. So we're talking about our data reduction from 40 megahertz, this is the bunch crossing at the LHC nominally, to about 1 kilohertz to storage. So this is a hard limit due to mostly the storage. We cannot store more than that. And this is slightly more for LHCB, just for a different system. So what are the limitations to recording all the data? Well, first of all, that you have to read the detector out. There's millions of detector channels. You have to reconstruct this data, so your computing resources might be limited. You have to store it on disk, so you have to save the events somewhere and keep them for later. But it's a competition between different physics channels, so you can't record all the QCD in the world because there's no room for leptons anymore. So your bandwidth is a product of event rate and event size. So these are the event rates that the LHC gives you, 40 megahertz, and this is the event rates that the various collaborations can deal with. And they are somehow related to the fact that there's event sizes are different. So Atlas and CMS have a megabyte or the megabyte data to store, while LHCB has a little bit more. So this is one of the problems, but it's also not all about bandwidth, because if you don't have a trigger, you're actually not recording anything just because you don't have that selection criteria in your menu. So this is what this experimental plenary is going to try and cover. So we have 3 times 20-minute slot that should serve as taster for block 3. And interruption and questions are welcome at any time, but then we will interrupt every 20 minutes and then move whatever discussion there is to the block itself that's going to happen in the next few days. So Antonio is going to talk about motivation implementation of the trigger level analysis. I'm going to talk about more different analysis with different timings for the LHC. And Matt is going to talk about the last part, this use case for composite Higgs for triggering outside exotic Higgs as use case to trigger outside the box. I think I talked to someone here about composite Higgs and then I got them mixed up. So yeah, let's start right away with Antonio. You need the microphone.
Okay, so this is more about just showing you a use case to illustrate what we're talking about. So we're not increasing the energy of the LHC anymore. So a big part of what we're going to be doing is looking for lower and lower rate signals. Because this is about we have fixed resources in the trigger, fixed data volume we can read out. We want to more efficiently use that data volume. And one way to do that is this so-called data scouting or trigger level or online analysis technique that all four LHC experiments are using in some way. And that is to either recognize that for certain triggers, we don't need to actually record all of the detector information or the full channel readout of certain pieces of the detector. But rather, we only need to record specific pieces that are relevant to the sort of analysis that you might want to do for that with that trigger. So that immediately gives you a reduction in the event size, which then allows you to increase the event rate that you're recording. Another version of that approach is to actually only record the sort of summary information about the results of an analysis that you're actually doing online in the trigger. Doing that in either respect requires that you work on making the evaluations of what the event looks like in the trigger closer to what the offline analysis sees. And that's an improvement that then feeds back into all of these offline analysis as well, because if you're improving the trigger turn-ons, et cetera, then you're helping out those analyses. So these are just two plots showing the sort of rates that CMS and Atlas are both using for run two versions of this sort of data scouting technique. So order a kilohertz or 1.5 kilohertz of events in sort of jet triggers, and also sort of a factor of 10 below that in muon triggers. So the first example of this is sort of the simplest example, where you only really care about the calorimeter information, the jets. You can do analyses just with jets and no other objects, beat down the trigger thresholds. So this is a plot showing a summary of diJet searches for a model that just has it's a Z prime with just a quark coupling. So there's no dileptron decays in this model. And the point of doing this for this simplified model is just to not just show limits in mass, but actually show you what the limits on the coupling look like as a function of mass for other experiments, as well as for the current generation of LHC experiments. And you can see that at higher masses, our sensitivity sort of is best at around 1 TeV, and this is because this is the threshold set by the fact that we're using single jet triggers, and the PT threshold for the single jet triggers is something like 300 or 400 GeV, and that immediately, with the other event cuts that are used for the analysis, immediately gives you sort of turn on at this mass. And then you can continue to improve these limits just by running the LHC for longer. There's not anything else to do here. But down here, your sensitivity drops off rapidly because all of these, most of these analyses here are just from the LHC are just done using pre-scaled triggers or fractions of the data that was totally available. And then these other curves are showing the UA2 and Tevatron results that were done at lower collision energies. And you can see,
I don't see any results with the pre-scaled triggers.
So this blue curve from Atlas is using that. So this is a combination of all of the pre-scaled single jet triggers, as well as park data sort of above 700 or 800 GeV. So that approach doesn't do as good as, say, for example, CDF down here at 300 or 400 GeV in diJet mass, despite the CDF result only using one inverse femtobarn of their data. So there's a big hole here, and the question is, Of course, we probably should be constraining this at least as well as we can at higher masses, but where is the floor here? At some point, you can go for lower and lower rate processes, and of course that's always interesting, but there's also there's a judgment decision about how long you push this, and having an idea of what sort of viable ranges of this coupling are necessary to probe is important. So there are dark matter models that we've already discussed from the LHC dark matter forum, and this plot, which is just done for a fixed set of couplings, so it's a slice of that previous plot at high dark matter masses where essentially the dark matter decay is irrelevant, so it's just the quark coupling, and this reduces to that model that we just saw. And here, these 8 TeV results can just be mapped onto this exclusion curve. So at around 600 or 700 GeV, you get to a coupling of about 1.5 in this model, and this LHC dark matter forum model is basically the same thing without this factor of 6 in the Lagrangian term. And so you end up getting this exclusion regime. But if you reduce this quark coupling, this is a pheno study done of the coupling dependence. Reducing the quark coupling kills your diJet rate down here below the kinematic turn on for the dark matter decays. And you can then get into a situation where instead of, so this is a plot showing it's flipped the axes from the previous set of plots. This is the Z prime mass on the vertical axis, and this is the dark matter mass on the horizontal axis. And you can see that for large quark couplings, this is all totally ruled out by diJets as well as monojets. But if you crank down that quark coupling, there's some freedom to increase the dark matter coupling to keep monojet constraints relatively interesting. But there's essentially a big hole here that opens up. At least for this model, the existing diJet constraints on light resonance are not strong enough in order to do this, and we want to be there. This is sort of compatible with the dark matter relic density, and we want to be able to probe that region. So then just to show what's actually being done, this is the ATV CMS Digest data scouting result. And you know, they're, instead of starting at around 1 or 1.2 TeV, you're able to go down to 400 GeV in Digest invariant mass, which then allows them to set limits about 500 GeV and above. Atlas has implemented this strategy for run two, and this is just a sort of showing you the, rather than the final results, the some of the performance quantities here. This is the gain that you get in statistics from the pre-scaled single jet triggers with the offline strategy to the data scouting technique as a function of the jet PT, and so you get about a factor of 10 or so down here at say 180 GV or so in jet PT. So these are coupling values that I think they picked out from the exclusion. I didn't actually check that, but I imagine that's what it is. Yes. That's the claim.
The thing is that you have a really small background, sort of, with the effect. So you actually
yes.
Well, you have to believe you're right.
How can you exclude that?
That's
some representative.
No, that's actually that's actually this. I mean, so you have assuming that you know you can predict the background in here by interpolating between these two sidebands, that and you have that shape correct, then you have an enormous statistical precision from that. So you know, the claim is you can see a signal of that order on that background prediction because it's sort of sub nil. So this is 700 GV, a coupling of 0.37, and if you go back to this actual result, at 700 GV, the coupling is sort of 0.37. So that's the claim. Okay, and then this last plot is just showing you, of course, you have to bring the trigger level object performance up to the level of the offline. This is the jet PT in the trigger over the offline PT as a function of the offline jet PT. And after applying after deriving a calibration that is almost as good as the offline, the performance is comparable to the offline. So. That's sort of, in a nutshell, what's been done so far. But the idea is that this is more ambitious, and this goes into other. This is sort of a prototype of maybe longer term, moving more stuff into the trigger to get around these limitations. So, of course, when you do that, you're not recording the full data. And so if you have a discovery of something, or you see a signal, you may be in a situation where you don't have enough information to follow up on that, and you have to plan very carefully about what other information you're storing in order to be able to verify a signal. I mean, the worst case scenario would be that you see a really low rate signal that takes most of the LHC run two or run three to identify, and then it's already too late to put in the extra triggering information that you need to record that information. So another important topic is that you know, there are other potential applications of this. Designing those triggers as we move into run two is important. For future upgrades of the detector, there are ideas for adding additional processing capability to sort of write out summary moments. For example, if for a jet substructure, you could do some more sophisticated calculations in the trigger, augment that maybe with a hardware processor, and then write out those substructure moments in the output data stream, but not the individual calorimeter cells that would allow you to compute those. I think the other two questions are sort of self-evident, but maybe in the interest of not using all of the time for this discussion, maybe this is a good point to stop and see if there are any comments or questions.
As you go to say high luminosity lighting, is essentially just going to scale with statistics, or do you ever reach a point where the signal is so small that you start being sensitive to mismodeling of the background shape?
Right. I mean, this is sort of In practice, what's happening in this analysis is you're fitting this to a four-parameter function. And there are, this is not shown in terms of the number of events, but there are, you know, a million events in each bin here. And so there's a very, very small statistical uncertainty. At some point, this function is just an empirical guess of, and it's worked well so far, but at some point, you know, the underlying QCD is a lot more complicated than that, and there's detector effects, et cetera. So you would expect that at some point that you resolve the difference between the function, your sort of ansatz, and the actual data. We don't seem to be at that point yet. That may become a problem eventually, and so then you would run into a systematic wall that you then have to deal with. Okay, let's move on to the second bit then.
So this part is a bit more diverse, so there's going to be more places to stop, and I mean, it depends on what people are interested in, can go on or not. So here I've made a plot of LHC analysis, and the ones I know about, there might be more. But this is the x-axis is the data complexity or the size of the data that you use, and the y-axis is the time to access the data for the analysis. So generally, we are all here, so we take quite a bit to get our data because it needs to be reconstructed. There's various calibration loops, but we get it a little bit later, and then we do an analysis, and the turnaround time it can be, I don't know, from weeks to months. That's a general. It also very much scales with the amount of people that are working on something. But still, let's keep that out. Well, you didn't see the digest, right? That was, yeah. No, still, I exclude the approval process. Generally, we're here, but then we've talked about the trigger level analysis, and this is where you actually could get the data before, but you actually save it offline, and then you reprocess it, you calibrate it, and you use it. So it's to the level, it's more, the data complexity is smaller, but you still have to wait a little bit. So there's other two directions you can go. You can do a real-time analysis, so as soon as it comes out of the detector, take the data, make the plots, throw out everything else. This is not quite yet there, but the LHCb is doing something like this with the calibration, so we're going to talk about this. And then there's also another way to go is, the monitoring part is you record the data and you look at it right away. You have an analysis ready and you make some plots right off when the data is recorded to the final step. And this is in Atlas we have the tag data analysis, didn't find anything public for CMS, but I think there's something like that. And then you can go for delayed data analysis and you can wait a little until a shutdown, for example, where you can actually reconstruct more data that you've just parked away. And then there's other joint measurements where usually the bottleneck is not enough people working on it, so that's why it's sort of up in the scale, but it's still an interesting way to trigger on things.
What's involved in
tag? So yeah, I'll go through the various things one by one. So here, LHCb, I wanted just to point out and follow up on the data scouting idea. This is the same. You can have your trigger output limited, so you can have the full stream, the one that you reconstruct fully, and then you have a turbo stream that is somehow the equivalent of the data scouting stream, although there's more calibration involved in real time at that point. So by the time it gets here, it's pretty much already ready to go. You don't have to wait and do the calibration offline. And the tagline here for LHCb is turbo stream, 20% of the trigger at 2% of the cost. But the interesting thing here is the application that it's not just jets, it's also new physics at low mass, so in general dark photons. This principle is the same. You have large backgrounds and you have a good precision for the object that you're looking at. For example, the mass resolution for the dielectron part. So at this point, you can actually put together a proposal for doing dark photon searches, and LHCb would cut out in a bit of the phase space coupling and the mass of this dark photon that isn't used before. So here, their point is that the online and the offline reconstruction are really close together. And this is thanks also to the buffering. So they have a disk that they can buffer and then realign with fresh data and update the constants in real time and then reapply them to the next set of data. So you basically bootstrap your own calibration for the detector thanks to some extra buffering and computing power that you have. So here's the first question, that mini poll, and I'd like a show of hands here. If we saw new physics in a trigger level analysis, how many people would believe it? Given that we have a lot of performance plots and that we tell you, really, we believe that the offline and online calibrations are the same.
It depends what, right? If it's an X peak in the mass distribution or if it's a broad excess, right?
So I don't know. See, think about...
I don't think we're going to get much help even for 750.
Well, 750, so if you had like 750 at 4 sigma or 5 sigma, think about that. 5 sigma of 750, going through the trigger only. Would you believe that?
I'll back it up for a second and ask a question specific to LHP. What is the point of doing it so fast? And sacrifice and raising the possibility of this question?
Well, I think this is more a question that comes from Atlas, or it's from the proposal. So
LHP is planning to do this. Why?
Well, it's because it's the same principle. If you have the full stream, you can't record all the data. You have to. It's the same point as the trigger level analysis. It's just a different kind of object that they look at. They don't have jets, they are a jet.
Why do they have to do the analysis in real time?
No, the calibration is done in real time.
Okay. Yes, but I don't understand. So a priori, I'm really happy to wait 2 or 3 months.
Right. But okay, so the point is that you can improve on something on the while you're taking the data. So if you're improving on your calibration and accumulating the data while you calibrate using this stream by itself, why not?
A major issue for them?
It's not necessarily a major issue, but you can get to the same point faster, and it's basically for free. You have this buffering there, so we use it. You can also do it offline. Yeah.
Which is a 48 hours,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you can do it in 48 hours.
You're not willing to wait 48 hours?
No, I think it's... So here maybe I confuse you a bit, because I'm talking about the trigger level analysis rather than the online real-time analysis. We're not real-time analysis yet, and I'm not sure we're going to get there.
I don't care about real-time analysis at all.
Right.
That's fundamentally at all. I would rather wait for 2 or 3 months and have it be right. Mm-hmm. Nice, and I believe it. Real-time, I got a Twitter feed or something.
No, this is more for the previous part of the talk. The question is.
For some of the signals, you're not going to be able to. It's the same thing as scouting, right? You're not going to be able to record all of the events. Right? So you're doing that in real time. So for those who pay, you're kind of forced into it.
So if you only have a limited amount of information, if you only think about the jet case, not forget about the LHCb.
Right.
You have 4 vectors for the jets, some information about the quality of the jets. You see a bump. Do you believe that bump?
So the fact that it's real time is relevant. What matters is
at this point,
More net data for a race.
For this, yes. For this question, yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not sure the answer is that to come from any analysis of this. Until I see it in another experiment, I don't necessarily believe it.
Right.
Definitely, this would be a case where confirmation from the experiment with a different. We've got two experiments doing trigger level analysis, but they're quite different from the detectors. Mm-hmm. They both see it.
So you'd be happy with seeing 2 trigger level analysis, but
yes.
Is there a need to see also the offline analysis on top of it? This is something that you were talking about yesterday.
That's not possible because of...
Yeah. Right. What if it's not possible?
The analysis of trigger level is going to be very different from the time when you go offline. It's not going to be some crazy just structure. It's going to be resonance peak.
Yeah.
Something fairly straightforward. So yeah, if I see a nice peak at trigger level and then I see it again someplace else, I mean, the analysis is simpler, so it's okay to be critical.
Standard analysis has a bunch of cross-checks that get done, and I think you have to design the cross-checks also with the trigger objects, and if you do the same cross-checks with the trigger objects,
you'd be happy to see it.
It's not like the full data.
Yeah.
The full data.
It's a wrong approach to be happy with trigger level analysis. Reduce bandwidth to get more interesting events and lower masses is good.
Yes.
And having some real-time information that lets you change, the bandwidth decisions are made by the collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have a signal emerging, you can easily give the full event to at the expense of other things.
Yeah, I think you have to convince people that it's real before, because if they don't believe it, they're not going to give the bandwidth.
I can tell you that I would have no trouble convincing my colleagues to do that. Is that the reason why the real-time thing is valuable? That's what we call scouting. So scouting is you wouldn't use it for an analysis, although we have. But the idea of real-time is scouting the data to see if you you see an emerging signal. I mean, I would like to point out, by the way, that the trivial-level analysis has a really important advantage over all-time analysis, which is that it's a truly blind analysis in the traditional sense. You set all your parameters, you press play, you close your eyes, you open, and you start the clock.
But we're pretty good at doing that.
No, I know, I'm overly good at doing that. It's fine, but I'm saying it's not necessarily drawing.
The problem is that you've made an a priori decision about what parts of the event are interesting. Yeah. You can lead you to the wrong conclusion about what those events are if you don't have the full information.
Is the question, is there other objects in the event? You can't answer that.
You've decided what was important already, and you're never going to know what else is there.
Yeah, I mean, take this digest scale as an example. So you can't, for like a 200-300 GeV digest resonance, even if you devoted the entire experimental bandwidth to the I don't think you would be able to read that over. So you're already hit with a problem, you have to do that. Then look at the 750 GeV case as an example. What's the first question? One of the first questions we ask is there anything else being produced in these events?
Well, no.
And you don't have that information.
Can I ask a basic question? So, the James kind of thing, where you have this, it's beautiful memory of this low mass digest resonances, do you get precisely two photons per event that gets fed out?
No.
Do you get just the hardest few, or could you do three jet resonance search? I mean, can
yes.
Okay, fine. Good. Okay, so you do get a bunch of four vectors of whatever you specify, and then with that on that level you can play.
But you can't necessarily arbitrarily answer the question that theorists will come back with or other experimenters in your collaboration of what else. When we see a signal, we like to actually understand everything about it. If there are tracks there, we'd like to see what's the EDX associated with each hit, because if it's really a massive particle, we should see more ionizations.
Sure.
You can't do any of that. So sure. It's not a good strategy, is my opinion. It's not a good strategy to just ignore information. It's a good way to see that something's there in mass range.
Okay, but hang on a minute. I mean, not in a community.
I'm much more optimistic about the limitations that
anyone.
They're all limited by money and people and the idea is to do physics. We should make sure we know what we're doing. So we should run for 5 years and do a trigger level analysis at the end of 5 years and then say we can't answer those questions and then we never get that data back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, okay. So what's the correct attitude, the correct attitude, you want to do trigger-level analysis because they're so shitty. You want to do them in real time. I'm sorry, in the sense that
I know, right?
Because you don't get the full information.
I mean, you definitely want to confirm it somewhere.
They're so uniquely valuable, but they are so limited by their very nature. You want to do them in real time so that if something Razor said, you can go, we need an extra $10 million and all these new processors and all these new blah 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 people, and then you can
that's the scouting thing. Ideally you do changes that are less disruptive than that. Okay, Antonio's right, if the signal happens to be way down there, we won't go hit these, you will have to spend a lot of money.
But there are hurdles, right? So a fraction of these events will be fully reconstructed offline. So from the viewpoint of understanding the detector, you still have all of the information for a subset at least.
It may not be the subset that's in the...
No, but if you're worried about the trigger level objects are somehow different from the fully digested ones, that's something you can study in detail.
That you do usually beforehand, though.
It's not the case for... I'm not talking about the case for the standard model ones where you have a lot where 1% of the stream is the same as the other 99%. I'm talking about if you think you have an unusual 0.1% of the events that you've got on your trigger stream, I want to know more about them, and you tell me I can't.
You're out of luck if it's
why don't we talk any specific of that plot from CMS? Suppose there was a 4 sigma, 5 sigma effect in there, then what, at that level, because that's tiny, right? That would be a 2 sigma, right? Because it's excluded. So make it twice as big, that's 4 sigma, which is pretty exciting. What would you do then?
I think it's, first of all, it's like Chris says, try get...
Right there.
Like here?
Blue one.
It's a nice, interesting place, right?
In that specific situation.
Seven, okay, forget
I would just
let's put it at 650, at 550. So that's not, okay.
You have to look elsewhere.
Yeah. One thing you could do is record in a mass window, maybe tightly around the peak, all of the events with the full react. Also, in sort of a set of supplemental triggers like that, also start writing out more information about what else is in the event to see if you can trigger off something else.
I mean, there's no limitation in, well, there's some limitation in how well you know the things at the trigger level, but all the information you get at the trigger level is potentially you can write it out at that point.
There's also some limitation on how well you know things at the analysis level. So mm-hmm. it's just a matter of, you know, there are things you can do at the trigger level to convince yourself that what you're seeing is makes sense.
You may not get the whole column. You just need to add an interesting subset around
it. Can I understand? And there's something with this. There's something with this discussion I don't understand. First of all, I mean, there is the, I understand the issue of looking at sure that the detector's working properly, but then I can, your applies to that. And then to your question of when, you know, maybe there's something else going on in the signal we need to know. DDX was one example, displacement might be another, something where the tracks are doing something. There are other handles for getting at those things which have lower thresholds, at least in principle, if you can trigger on them. So then the real issue is, so on one hand, there are special things that can show up that you're missing, but you can try to trigger on those directly. Conversely, if it's things that are standard, like a lepton or a med, mm-hmm. you're picking that up anyway. I'm trying to understand, what are we really worried about?
If you could convince me that there was no, that anything else we would be interested in would already be on tape for some other means, and I could convince myself that if this event were interesting in that way, it would be heavily recorded by other trigger late library example, then I would be less interested.
So then I think maybe that's the discussion to have for half an hour, I mean, or an hour in the block.
Yeah.
I mean, is there really a word here,
yeah.
or is there really not?
I like that idea.
In version of the statement of selecting on a mass window, you could do a thing where you see a peak. And I mean, you know, I have no feeling for these rays, but they are looking at what you normally
We move this discussion to the block, so that in the next 5 minutes, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure.
Because we have another interesting part after this. And someone wanted to see this monitoring analysis thing. OK, so this is the what you were asking about, is this express analysis.
Let me interrupt for a moment and just say goodbye, everybody. I'm thinking
about bye. So this is nothing more than just a framework to just, whenever the data gets recorded, you pick out root entuples and you run a script on it that does analysis on it. The advantage is that at the same time as you get the data written out, you also get a histogram, including your standard model backgrounds and your data on top. So this is like a global search. There's a bunch of channels. And this is usually used to monitor the performance. So this is one way that we've found even detector problems that we couldn't spot before. Because you see, I don't know, a drop in distribution A that you expect to be smooth, and it's not. And you wouldn't have seen it in the monitoring plots because they don't have Monte Carlo on the bottom. So you don't usually, in the monitoring, you usually compare data to a reference of a previous run, and it's low statistics, it's run by run, this accumulates statistics. So it's been useful for doing this kind of monitoring checks. But now the question that is...
just a question on this. How long does it take for this part to come out?
I don't know, it's like the... 48 hours or something.
But it adds the data to the...
It adds the data to the previous data, yeah, it accumulates. Yeah, so it's a web page, basically. You just refresh the web page when run is done. So does CMS have something like that? Because someone talked to me about it. This is public information, so I can talk about it. But, you know. OK, so the question that one can raise here, and there's a variety of opinions, is it, what about, you? Are you unblinding everything by looking at this web page?
I really do not like this, but we had fights with the people who do this. Didn't win. Mm-hmm. To me, I had real trouble. There's a sociological aspect to this which really troubled me, which is that you have these entire teams of people who are focusing on this one channel there, and they're investing months and years of their lives, and they're doing it blind, and then on the side is this web page that just unblinds the data freely like this, and they're supposed not to look, and there's a real sociological mm-hmm. issue with this. It's not okay. How can you have it both ways?
Yeah, I think this is a point of debate, because it's something that is, there's two sides to this. There's one side that says, well, we're monitoring things and we're never going to put out an excess based on this. But of course, when you see something here, then you start thinking about doing an analysis and, you know, you're not blind anymore. You really are not.
Everything relies on people being honest. So why not apply that here and go, okay, I'm going to have a group of people whose job is to check on this, and they are going to...
Outside the team.
Yeah, they are not going to be doing an analysis. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like, there will be someone who, you know, someone checks, it's someone's job to check the NME spectrum, and this person is going to do a analysis or something. So, like, people have assigned responsibilities, and they shut up about it.
They shut up about it.
If there was something, you would hear at some point that there would be a bug. So if you're working at the United States on the blind side, there's no way you wouldn't hear from the people who look at these
as a theorist, I like context to weigh these various things, but I mean, you tell me that this isn't the way to detect the technical problem, so it's like, well, there's a reason to do this. I mean, it's not...
No, they're doing this to find physics.
It's not a publicity stunt, right? Like Heraclitus is something, so...
An example of a place where, there are certain plots where new physics would tend to get washed out and detector problems would show up. Mm-hmm. ET plot, for example. So there are plots, I mean, this is a very dangerous plot.
I put it on purpose.
What is it?
Dielectron mass.
What worries you about it?
It completely undercuts the efforts of a team of people who are doing the blind analysis. And whose motivation...
Maybe they're wasting their time, because I can see a peak right away, so why do I No, I'm serious.
I think,
right here, I don't need to do a blind analysis and go years and years of work. It's a waste of time.
So then you're probably, that is a true statement for probably half of the searches, where you could just do the plot like this, they can make the math. Is there something by eye or not? Okay, done without even...
No, then if there's nothing, then you have to publish. You have to do the careful thing about making limits, et cetera, which is a publishable thing, which is what you need to publish, because there's a worth in publishing null results. Are we agreeing with that? Right? But in terms of all of this holier than thou blind analysis for a z prime to e plus e minus peak, what the heck? Why?
All right, I'm going to cut off the discussion here.
That's part of the excitement of doing these searches, that there could be something. And if you take that away now, and you're just, your job is to just do the hard work of setting the limit.
Let's discuss this in the block, and then the last 1 minute of this central part is about things that are more unusual, where you have two detectors at the same time that one triggers on the other. So it's an expensive statement to say ATLAS is the trigger for LHCF, but this is what happens in some cases. So you use the presence of something in ATLAS to something. Is there something central in the ATLAS detector to check something that is very forward that ATLAS cannot do? This is the principle of ATLAS and LHCF collaboration. So LHCF is another experiment that is only at Penn in ITA. And you join them, you use one to trigger on the other, and you use event formation from one to the other. And this, in this case, it's the aim is cosmic ray physics, but you have another example, this metal on the... This is for magnetic monopoles. It's on top of LHCb. It's just a set of sheets where you can record whether something is trapped in there. So the question is here for another block, are there any other ideas for parsity detectors and triggers? As long as you can do something cheap, then you can actually use something quite expensive to do work for you. So I think it's a cute idea. But with that, we should move on to the triggering outside the box part. And there's about 15 minutes for that.
So I'm amazed. Please. I have six. Questions on the first part that I anticipate. So I prepared very thin slides just because I wanted to really have more discussion. So if we're going to think about, from a theorist point of view, what are the types of issues that we can contribute to a discussion about triggering? The real issue is, in part, where are the places where the problems are arising? Sometimes the best way to think about that is take a case where we know already that there are issues and where we know there's good physics motivation and start with that. So let me start with exotic decays of the Stenner model like Higgs, because, hey, we know this particle actually exists. We know it's light, and therefore producing it poses problems for triggering. And we know that these types of decays, which arise in many models, basically take the energy of the 125 GeV and split it up. And therefore, individual objects tend to be quite low in PT. Just as a brief moment about why one should be considering this, I think everybody knows, there's all sorts of different types of models in which the Higgs, which is a very sensitive particle, can be coupled to a Higgs sector from what we now typically call Higgs portal. You can do this without screwing up anything else in the standard model. So everything can look standard model-like up to the point that we have now. There's not going to be any messing around with any measurements that have been done up to this time. And yet the Higgs can decay 10% of the time, 1% of the time, 10% of the time through some new channel to some new particles. And those decays then become perhaps the first, perhaps the only sign of new physics at the LHC. And therefore, it's really critical to make sure we don't miss these. It might be the only thing which tells us that this is not the standard model we're looking at. So the urgency, I think, is very high. And the challenge is considerable. One thing I should mention is that these exotic decays have now been tied into naturalness, which was something I wanted to do for a very long time. It was sitting in front of us for many years in the context of the Twin Higgs and Fulton Suzy. Anyway, now we know that it's sort of, in a way, almost obvious in retrospect that if naturalness involves a hidden sector, that hidden sector has to talk to the Higgs somehow. Otherwise, what else is it talking to? It has to involve the Higgs. And once the Higgs is involved in the hidden sector, there's a significant possibility the Higgs can decay to it, and then we have something chocolate. In the same context as has been known for longer, obviously if you have a theory of dark matter that involves particles in a hidden sector as well, you've had many such models. And even if it's not a hidden sector, the Higgs can decay to the dark matter. Or maybe the Higgs decay, which gives you invisible decays. Maybe the Higgs decays to friends of dark matter. Then the decays are potentially more elaborate, more interesting, because they don't have to be invisible. Not entirely invisible. The challenge, of course, for both analysis and for triggering is that there's a very large variety of possible final states. So we have to think through a lot of different cases and make sure we understand both how do we trigger on it and how would we analyze the data if we had it. Because it's easy to think of triggers that are not worth it, because when you actually do the analysis, you won't use the events that come in through that trigger anyway. So it's really, this is part of why real studies are required, and we maybe don't have enough of them yet, although we're certainly better off than we were a few years ago, because you can't really prioritize your triggering unless you've understood your analyses as well. And so it's a bit of a problem of circularity you have to work through. And this scenario is, again, typical, I think, of the types of scenarios we have similar conversations to have about dark matter and compressed spectra for SUSY or for anything else for that matter. So we can talk about this case in some more detail, but I think everything I'm saying about this case applies to other cases. So for the Higgs itself, there's a range of interesting final states you can think about. You can think about states that are fully visible that have just a few particles in them, like BB mu mu. Now, of course, that one's relatively easy to trigger on because you've got a pair of muons. But you know, you're already taking the energy of the Higgs and dividing it up into four particles whose energies of order 30 GeV. Maybe the muons are also very close together because this might be effectively a lepton jet. So there's a whole bunch of triggering issues to make sure that you understand even for these cases. If the number of final states gets larger, for example, if the Higgs is decaying to four BB bar pairs, now you're really in trouble. It's not even clear you can do that analysis, and it's certainly not clear how you would want to trigger on it. And maybe you should just throw it to LHCb, and they're the only ones who can try it. So I think there's a lot of unknowns here. Of course, if it's going purely invisibly, we know a lot about that case. We know a lot about triggering. There's been a lot of studying. Some of the great experts on theory side are in the room. But partly visible decays, which again connects us with some of the dark matter discussions, if you have a Higgs that's decaying, let's say, to a couple of friends of dark matter, which then decay to dark matter plus something visible, now those objects can potentially be very soft. And so you might be looking for two moderately soft photons plus missing ET, where neither the MET nor the photons are easy to trigger on. Or you might be looking for a couple of soft muons, maybe not hard enough for your standard dimuon trigger, plus a missing ET. And again, it's not clear whether the right strategy here is to trigger on the MET
to trigger on the soft objects, to trigger on both, and in what combinations. And then there's long-lived particles, and you know, you can have final states with just one long-lived particle that you actually have a chance of observing. The other one may leave the detector most of the time. Maybe you're lucky there are two of them, maybe there's more than two. Well, the triggering issues do depend, as the analysis issues do, a little bit on those different cases. Now, for the Higgs specifically, there's several different ways to approach the trigger. I'm sorry about these things having moved around when I sent them over to, yeah, it's a keynote versus PowerPoint problem. Okay, so when you're thinking about the Higgs, of course, there's three different approaches you can consider. You can focus on the production and be agnostic as to the nature of decay. Obviously, that has some big advantages, but you can only do it really for a VBF trigger or for a lepton trigger. You can focus entirely on the decay and be entirely agnostic about the production, which has the advantage that that same trigger is useful for things that have nothing to do with the Higgs, such as dark matter searches or compressed spectrum searches, where you're focusing on some MET, maybe a soft object, and a recoiling jet. Maybe you're focused on a long-lived particle. And then the most exclusive, but sometimes the most powerful by far, and sometimes necessary, is to have a combination where you're both, for example, VBF plus a soft object is something which is coming from the Higgs for sure, and it's specific to the nature of the Higgs decay. So that trigger is not so useful for so many different other searches, but it's powerful enough for the Higgs that in some cases you may want it. And so I think one of the discussions one has to have is what's the balance between these three types of triggering approaches? Again, once you've gone through the exercise for the Higgs, you know, the triggers that aren't Higgs specific, specifically the ones that don't really focus on VBF per se, are obviously valuable for other contexts. So invisible particles like dark matter are going to, any MET or MET plus soft object based trigger is useful there. Your same triggers may be useful for particles you don't know exist yet. You may be looking for the Higgs to do something interesting, but there might be some other light particle, maybe a second Higgs, whose decays are dominantly exotic, and you haven't discovered it yet, and you're going to need these triggers to find it. And of course, if you've got triggers for Higgs going to long-lived particles by focusing on the long-lived particles themselves, well, these long-lived particles can show up from many different sources. So you've got a useful strategy there. And obviously, a lepton plus anything, your lepton trigger is already very powerful. So a lepton plus an additional soft lepton and a lepton plus some other interesting feature is widely useful. So I think one of the questions for the block is, you've got all these different strategies, you've got all these different use cases, how do you organize it, and how do you make choices? And this is not something we'll be able to answer at a workshop like this, but the question you might ask is, should we have workshops focused on this specifically, and how would we organize them? Is the only way to do this kind of thing to have one of the experiments meet with a certain set of theorists and focus on making a real plan for which studies to do so you can actually have some crosstalk back and forth and solve these problems?
It's not happening so tomorrow.
Well, it might be hard to do it with two experiments, with two different, well, it might be hard to do it with all the experiments in conversation, because at some point you have to focus on what each experiment can do. Because each experiment really has its own set of issues. And the other thing is that I think it's not something you can do in a workshop, but it's really an ongoing conversation. Because obviously these things are moving targets. And also we have studies to do. We have to figure out what the studies are you want to do and then respond to those studies. So I think what was maybe lacking in run one was there wasn't much of a coherent effort here on this. There were scattershot issues, scattershot efforts. And a question for this block is, should we really force there to be a run two effort that's more coherent on these types of issues? Okay. There are some new opportunities, not all of which I'm remembering or know about, which theorists and experimentalists should discuss. At the Atlas, on the Atlas side, the fast track trigger, which is going to allow for some tracking information very early in run two, very powerful but very limited as well in certain senses, definitely offers some new opportunities. And I don't think that I think we should definitely discuss those. There might be some additional things that can be done with the innermost layer of silicon. I'm not sure if that changes anything or not, but it's something perhaps to discuss. Certainly with respect to B physics, with respect to multiple B tags, with respect to long-lived particles, maybe other things that I don't know about. There have been some level one improvements in both experiments. Atlas certainly has more kinematic information at level one, so there are new things that could be implemented, perhaps. I'm less clear on what improvements at CMS would be obvious targets for theorists to discuss with CMS, but there might be some, so that would be good to discuss. And also, I guess Scott was reminding me that FastJet level information, is that FastJet type information, is available now at level one. Is that correct? Somebody told me that. Somebody said this to me. Okay. To the extent that there is additional information about jets at some stage, and I don't know if it's level one, it would be very crude, but still may be useful, or if it's very early in level two, or essentially. Okay, so does the capability to do that offer other possibilities? For example, are there ways to trigger on unusual clusters or boosted objects that aren't, you know, totally swamped in background and where you could actually gain something?
Can I ask a question of the Atlas and San Francisco in the room? So the FTK story is pretty exciting because it gets sort of at a trigger level, it's just about level one, you get full tracking information on the business. Now, can someone maybe help me understand the difference between FTK and the fact that there is basically full track information available at CMS at high level trigger, right? So CMS has probably the full information at high level trigger, I think, because that's what allows you guys to do these displaced jet triggers and all these very nice track level type things once they're lifted at level one. Now, Atlas, FTK, so different approaches in tracking, et cetera, but will it end up being functionally equivalent, or is there something that FTK does extra that particle flow Atlas does not? What's the way that we can understand that?
So, what's the current implementation? What are the current sites that we're
talking about? You should answer the Atlas, but this is HTTP tracking at CMS is basically offline tracking for all of this.
We're the same on the thresholds.
So
on the Atlas side, the HLT tracking, the software tracking is run for regions of interest around level one. So there's a narrow cone and there's some tighter momentum threshold. So FTK throws out that region of interest requirement and it also lowers the momentum threshold to 1 GeV.
So it sounds like CMS at high level trigger. Not every single event gets fully tracking constructed or whatever, but maybe it has like a meltdown or something, that there will be something that's available that goes, pass this on from high level trigger particle flow reconstruction, and you can do
it. Yeah, it's the same thing.
Right, whereas, so at Atlas, would you end up with the functionally equivalent capacity of FTK, or is FTK really going to track everything that runs through level one?
Everything.
So that is a way in which it really is something, an upgrade, not just compared to what Atlas can do, but even compared to what CMS can do right now, and then the tracker.
So as long as there's a level one accept on
the That's right.
But that's coming to that. What he's saying is that as long as it gets out of level one, the tracking information for the whole detector, again, with limited set of questions, is available.
All 1 GeV or greater tracks.
All 1 GeV tracks that come pretty much from the vertex.
Yeah, the impact.
There's a couple millimeter. In practice, there's also requires that there are enough silicon hits in the track. So
it's pretty assume that they come from
It's not assumed. So we train the pattern recognition uniformly in D0 and D0 out to 2 millimeters or something. In D0, I think 5 centimeters. In D0. So it's fully efficient in practice. As soon as you miss more than one of the silicon layers, or you go outside that region.
So in other words, if you have a long-lived particle which has traveled a few centimeters and it decays, most of those tracks will be missed, possibly all of them. And there's just not enough space for all those different patterns. Yes. Yes.
Yes, you guys would still need something else to trigger. At high level trigger to make you run the full particle flow. But then you do bring a full particle flow, which means there's no limitation for getting this place.
I don't see how that's any different. But you still need a level one.
So you need a level one, but then you 100% process with a slightly sort of pared down track of instruction.
My understanding, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, there's a certain order in which things have to be done based on how long they take, and this is a way of doing one of them very fast with hardware for something, right, so that you can do that one, and that gives you do that one very quickly, and you do it always, and that gives you other pathways that you can take. In the end, the performance is going to be pretty similar, but there's going to be some particular use cases like B physics, where you can afford where you can be more confident you're picking up more of the Bs, because you'll see all of the Bs at level just after level one, and so that it's like you have a B tag there, which you can run every time.
Well, and I think more importantly, you can do much more sophisticated things with the more available time at the HLT than you could if you had to spend a lot of time.
Right.
Was that looked at in the context of Higgs to multi-B kind of state, for example?
The real reason why you have that decay is so it has nothing to do with any of this discussion. It's so that you can reject more background views than things that don't have track. It's just identifying events that have tracks, because otherwise you would be writing events that don't to take what you don't want. So it frees up bandwidth for you to do other things. That's the main advantage. But it's not that the tracks that you get are better.
It's giving you more information to make a better informed decision.
Faster. You get more information faster before you make decisions that you can't reverse. So. Just again, by comparison, seeing this particle flow story is something at high level trigger makes you choose to run the particle flow on this subset of the events that reach high level trigger. Right? We can take, I suppose I know, maybe it seems to be, we can take any level one seed and ask it to run track. You can't do that for everything. I don't think it's
true.
As long as there's some track there. So let's take 100% level that comes out level one can be tracked.
No.
Not 100%, because there's not enough processing time or output.
No, so that was my question. So ultimately you make that choice. I'm going to choose some level one criteria on which to run track, which would make
not just level, not necessarily level one. It could be level one plus HLT.
Right.
Imagine, I have enough energy.
This is a great conversation, but we will have a whole block to discuss it, and we have more to do on blocks one and two. This is a good place to stop. I'll just put up some questions, which conclude with a bunch of questions that I thought we might consider.
One is meeting in the tower room, and block two, I think we were talking about maybe going to, you can go to the seminar room behind us if it's free.